news when you want it. Get the latest headlines with the Bloomberg News Now podcast.
The latest developments in the war in the Middle East.
Inflation relief for consumers.
The top headlines from Bloomberg News, updated continuously throughout the day.
All in less than 5 minutes.
The House and Senate passing that spending bill.
Tesla's support among Wall Street bulls is weakening.
Get the latest news when you want it at the click of a button.
Now to the latest on the race for president.
Listen on Bloomberg.com.
The Bloomberg Business App.
And anywhere you get your podcasts. Bloomberg News Now. Context changes everything.
The ceasefire crumbled. Now Israel is expanding its military campaign in Gaza again.
It feels to me like a kind of Groundhog Day.
I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Today, what has changed and what hasn't in Gaza. Also, a tense back and forth between the U.S. and Iran over the prospect of another nuclear deal.
They clearly are threatening war because each of them knows that the other side doesn't want it.
Paris takes drastic measures to become bike and pedestrian friendly.
Every Parisian is quite conscious that there is less car, there is less congestion.
But not every Parisian is happy.
Plus, he says he is the only one in his musical genre, Afro-Appalachian.
All that and more today here on The World.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Thanks for joining us this Wednesday. Today, the Israeli military announced a major expansion of its operations in Gaza. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said his army had shifted gears overnight.
Netanyahu says the military is now seizing territories, striking terrorists, and destroying infrastructure. In particular, Israel is expanding a corridor that it's fought hard to keep control of. Netanyahu's move angered some inside Israel.
The statements caused widespread panic in Israel today, because the families of hostages felt that the government was issuing a death sentence to their loved ones who are still held in Gaza.
That's journalist Noga Tarnopolsky reporting from Jerusalem. We spoke this afternoon about how the renewed Israeli attacks on Gaza seem similar to the previous military campaign. So there are some new things happening here. As you said, talk of annexing more land in Gaza. But once again, the Israeli government is talking of eliminating Hamas or issuing evacuation orders. Some of this feels very familiar to the beginning of the offensive in Gaza. Is that how it looks to you? Does this feel a bit like deja vu?
It feels to me like a kind of Groundhog Day. Israel has bombed Gaza almost in every possible place. What's left of Hamas in Gaza is a very, very weak structure, if at all. And the only real thing left for the Israelis to do is to permit some alternative governance structure to take hold in Gaza. But Israel has been unwilling to spell out any governing body that it would accept there. And so it just seems like an ongoing grind with no end point. In Israel, obviously, the fate of the hostages is what is really just suffocating people here.
There are reports that the area around Rafah is now almost completely empty following evacuation orders. Again, people returned there during the ceasefire. Is this another round of evacuation and displacement, a continuation of that same story?
Absolutely. It's even possibly slightly worse than what it was before, because there were clearly defined humanitarian zones during the harshest part of this war. Whereas right now, the Israeli army is dropping leaflets on Palestinian localities in Gaza, telling people that this is a warning, that an airstrike is coming, they have to go. And they tell them you have to go to humanitarian zones without defining which. I think Gazans have almost nowhere left to flee.
Mm. Last week, we heard reports of people in Gaza taking to the streets to protest Hamas. And now today, videos are emerging of crowds marching in the streets in northern Gaza. We've got a bit of sound here. Some people are chanting Hamas out. Noga, who are the protesters and what are their demands? And I'm also curious how Israeli media is covering these protests.
It's getting quite a bit of publicity in Israel. And I think it's a bit confusing to Israelis who, for the last 18 months, have been fed by their leaders the notion that all Gaza are terrorists. So it's being seen with a kind of fascination. But what we're seeing behind the scenes is the beginning of kind of a breakdown of public order in Gaza. There have been a few cases of Hamas executing people accused of participating in these protests. So I think we have to highlight the bravery of these people who are going out. But there have also been cases, we heard yesterday, the case of a kind of a clan in Gaza executing a Hamas police officer who it accused of harming one of its members.
Noga, for over a month, no aid or commercial trucks have entered Gaza. That is the longest period since the start of the war without any aid making it into the Strip. What does that mean for conditions on the ground?
Today, the World Food Program shut down the remaining bakeries. They simply don't have enough flour. And there are images of women standing outside of bakeries crying for bread. I don't think Gaza is in a situation of famine just yet, but I think it is looming very, very close. And once again, the Israeli army has not made any statement in relation to this. On the other hand, some of Netanyahu's ministers have been openly demanding to starve Gaza so as to achieve the war's aims, which are to destroy Hamas. And so that's in the background of all of this.
Journalist Noga Tarnopolsky in Jerusalem spoke with us today about Israel's expanding military operations in Gaza.
Pro-democracy protests continue in Turkey over the jailing of Istanbul's mayor on corruption charges, but they have started to quiet down. Now Turkey's main opposition party is trying something new, a boycott. People are showing their support for the protests today by abstaining from buying or selling anything. The World's Duri Baskaran reports from Istanbul.
So it's Wednesday around lunchtime, and most days this part of my neighborhood would be totally full. People sitting outside, having a coffee, going to the stores. And today, it's just quiet. The restaurants are closed. A barbershop's open, but no one's getting a haircut. And I think the most surprising thing is realizing how many people around me have been supporting these protests without actually having any visible sign of it.
Near a ferry station, I meet Munir Ust, a retiree who's serious about the boycott. Injustices are being committed that cannot be undone, Ust says. They're arresting our young people. What is a 17-year-old doing in prison? This is why we're boycotting, Ust says. Maybe it's a small thing, but it has a great importance for us. Others, like a father named Selçuk, who asked not to use his full name due to the political risks, said he wouldn't participate in the boycott. They're creating chaos and trying to completely collapse the economy, Selçuk says. He says he's dissatisfied with Turkey's current leaders. The same party has been in power for more than 20 years. But he doesn't see how a boycott makes a difference. Why would I? I use Turkish products, he says. For weeks, leaders of imprisoned Mayor Ekrem İmamoğlu's opposition party have asked supporters to avoid pro-government TV channels and to stop spending money at businesses with close ties to the government, like a popular coffee chain and a bookstore. Calls for musicians like the English band Muse to cancel shows with a pro-government event planner have gathered thousands of online posts. In a statement today, Muse said it would postpone the show to next year.
If you want change, hit where it counts, economically.
Selva Demiralp is an economist at Koç University in Istanbul. She says the opposition's call for a boycott is a way to put pressure on the government beyond demonstrations in the street.
It's a tactic that could actually make a difference. If enough people stop buying from certain brands, those companies will feel it. And when profits take a hit, things start to move.
At least 1,900 people have been arrested in connection to pro-democracy demonstrations across the country in recent weeks. But some protesters, like 25-year-old Ezgi Cengiz, fear the movement has lost momentum.
They deliberately took the people who organized the protests
The arrests have left the movement fractured, Cengiz says, with ultranationalist and anti-Kurdish voices beginning to drown out the centrist pro-democracy message of the first days.
They started to overwhelm the group. They started to direct the group and everything. So the revolutionary potential of the protests decreased gradually, day by day.
There are signs that the Turkish government will prosecute boycotters as well. This morning, the chief public prosecutor's office announced it would investigate, quote, divisive discourses known as boycott calls in traditional and social media outlets, which are aimed at preventing the public from engaging in economic activity. In a small park in the hip, liberal neighborhood of Moda, İsa Atabey says he supports the boycott. Like 75% of the shops here are closed today, says Atabey. There are no customers, nobody is here. People used to be afraid, Atabey says, but they aren't afraid anymore. For The World, I'm Derya Buscarin, Istanbul.
The Italian government is shrinking the number of people who can get citizenship there based on Italian ancestry. A new decree by Italy's foreign minister says your ties to Italy must be relatively recent to get an Italian passport. We asked Samantha Wilson to explain the change. She's CEO of Smart Move Italy, a company that helps people gain Italian citizenship.
It used to be that the citizenship law was really generous. And before, you could go back to your great-grandparents or even beyond. But now you can only find yourself eligible for Italian citizenship by blood if you had a parent or a grandparent that was Italian.
So this is going to cut a lot of people off from Italian citizenship that would have been eligible in previous years. Why have some of those people been applying for citizenship? What's the major motivator here?
I think Italians have this sense of belonging. It really is a culture that is built on family and relationships, so it transcends generations. And because there was huge migrations of Italians to the U.S. and beyond in the early 1900s, there is this connection or this sense of connection to Italy. And many, you know, Americans want to be reconnected with their ancestors and with their heritage. So they've been seeking this, and thousands of people every year look for their Italian citizenship. But as you mentioned, many will be cut off now, probably more than half.
Lots of South Americans as well, people from Argentina, for example. And I imagine that a lot of people are specifically looking for a European passport, right? That's a big motivator, too.
Well, this is one of the bigger questions of why this Tajani decree came out. And it was the argument that people who were seeking their Italian citizenship weren't seeking it to be part of Italy in general. They wanted another passport that was maybe better than theirs. And, you know, Argentina or Brazil is two of the places specifically that they were talking about. And this is because their passports can't open up the world as easily as the Italian one. So they have no desire to move to Italy or even be involved in Italy in any way. They just want the Italian passport. And this, according to the ministry, is, you know, not acceptable.
So you help clients get Italian citizenship. I'm wondering what you're hearing from folks right now and what you're telling them about their chances.
Yeah, well, they're devastated. And one of the reasons isn't just because of the ineligibility that some people now are facing after years and a lot of money, you know, planning and preparing. It's the suddenness of the decision, the lack of giving anybody any reasonable transitional period between the change in the rules and now. So people have been spending thousands and thousands, $10,000, $15,000, $20,000 just on getting their citizenship to suddenly wake up the next morning saying it's gone.
You mentioned that Italy's laws here are quite generous. I know that other European countries do offer citizenship from ancestry, but how does Italy compare and how widespread is this, maybe specifically in Europe?
Well, Italy has been very generous, as I had said, because it's a jus sanguinis country, which means that jus sanguinis means by blood. So you are Italian if you're born to an Italian person. This is why naturalization was so important in Italian citizenship. In other words, if your ancestor naturalized, became another citizen, like an American, before the next in line was born, the next in line then would be born to an American, no longer Italian, breaking the line. So if you're looking at the late 1800s, you could actually be going back to that ancestor to prove the line right to you, which is incredibly generous. Most countries in Europe only go to the parent or the grandparent, which is falling in line of what Italy, I think, will end up being after the changes.
Samantha Wilson is the CEO of Smart Move Italy. She spoke with us from Florence. From Italian passports to the streets of Paris, just ahead, the mayor of the City of Lights says, leave your car at home. You're listening to The World.
It's Madeline Barron from In the Dark. I've spent the past 4 years investigating a crime.
When you're driving down this road, I might plan on killing somebody.
A four-year investigation, hundreds of interviews, thousands of documents, all in an effort to see what the U.S. military has kept from the public for years.
Did you think that a war crime had been committed?
I don't have any opinion on that.
Season 3 of In the Dark is available now, wherever you get your podcasts.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. There's a showdown in Paris over who owns the streets. The city's mayor has been on a mission to make Paris the most walkable, bikeable city on earth. Many residents are on board. They did just vote to ban cars from some 500 streets. But not all Parisians are swooning over the plan. The World's transportation correspondent Jeremy Siegel explains.
C'est avec fierté que je reçois cette immense et belle responsabilité.
When Anne Hidalgo assumed office in 2014, she promised big changes. That included getting rid of gridlock. Supporters say 11 years later, she's followed through.
In my living experience of Paris is a very car-centric city when I was younger, a very polluted city. It was basically a long traffic jam.
Clément Rogna is with the advocacy group the Clean Cities Network and supports the mayor's latest initiative, which will eliminate 10,000 parking spots and replace miles of road with trees and walkable, bikeable paths. He says under Hidalgo, the city has changed dramatically through millions of euros worth of investments in bike lanes and crackdowns on cars. Today, Rogna says, Paris is much closer to the stereotype of a city full of people on bikes and baguettes.
I'm not sure if every Parisian has a baguette in their arm, but we really see a huge difference in terms of the number of bikes. Every Parisian is quite conscious of the fact that there is less car, that there is less congestion, that there is better air quality, that the overall quality of life has really improved.
But Hidalgo's transformation of Paris hasn't been without speed bumps. Many drivers are staunchly opposed. There have even been shocking incidents of violence, including the murder of a cyclist by an SUV driver last year after a disagreement about bike lanes.
Time and time again, there's so many news articles about road rage, about anger and aggression.
Meredith Glazer heads up the nonprofit Urban Cycling Institute in Belgium. It advocates for bike-friendly infrastructure in Europe and across the globe. She says it's all too easy for drivers to flip into a rage when they think cyclists are encroaching on their space.
Once we open up our streets to slowing down to more trees and plants and benches, places where people can actually stay and play and linger, and then we open up new kinds of emotions.
Marco te Brummelstroot, who studies traffic and urban mobility at the University of Amsterdam, says that's what Paris's plan gets right. The recent vote, he says, wasn't about banning cars. It was about opening streets up to the people who want to use them. He points to recent research finding that the vast majority of trips around Paris are made on foot, public transportation, and bicycles. Cars represent just 4%.
It's already such a small minority, which makes it very weird that we always focus on that minority.
Still, Hidalgo's latest plan is coming under fire. Critics say low turnout in the vote, just 4% of Paris's population, means a small minority of residents are deciding the fate of the city's streets. Yves Carras, the spokesman for a large Parisian automobile club, says he's not opposed to some streets being made car-free, but he worries that automobiles and commuters who rely on them to get into the city center are being left behind.
Normalement, c'est pour améliorer la vie des gens. C'est pas pour leur compliquer la vie.
Politics is supposed to be about improving people's lives, he tells me, not complicating them. And we'll see what happens with next year's election. Hidalgo isn't seeking another term in that election, but the choice of whether to continue her transformation of Paris will likely be on the ballot. In Kara's view, it's time to hit the brakes. For The World, I'm Jeremy Siegel.
Way out in the South Pacific, the tropical island of Bougainville is devoutly Catholic. When the world's Patrick Wynn reported on Bougainville last year, he visited a shrine for St. Mary that many Bougainvillians believe has supernatural powers.
The ladies see me coming. They're huddled in the eave of their wooden shrine, staying out of the rain. Hello. I've come just in time to see Marina, the shrine's caretaker, saying the Hail Mary.
Ave Maria, you pull up long gracia, Lord is top long you.
That's Hail Mary, full of grace, the Lord is with you, in Talk Pisan, an English-based Creole that's spoken here.
Mama belong God, pray belong help me.
56-year-old Marina Caresu is the person in charge here. You can just tell. Her brown eyes shine with authority. She's got a story to share about a foot-tall wooden statue of Mother Mary, the icon for which this shrine was built. It rests in an alcove built into the wall behind her.
We feel the presence of Mother with us while we are praying here in the shrine.
Marina tells me there was once a missionary priest from Europe who lived in a small house nearby.
He brought it from Italy.
Long time ago.
Yes, early 70s, when we were still little children.
In the early 90s, everything changed. There was an uprising here for independence, which turned into a full-blown war with Papua New Guinean troops. Marina, like most villagers, fled to live in the jungle. As for that priest, by the time locals dared to come check on him in 1994, his house was nothing but a heap of ash.
The house was burnt down. We don't know who burnt it, actually, but underneath the ash was the statue. It was underneath.
Every other bit of the house was burnt to cinder, she says, except for the statue of Mary. Locals hailed it as a miracle.
What happened? Our miracles was really based on our prayers.
Simon Koraikove is another survivor of the war, which lasted until the early 2000s. He's also a former top official in the Roman Catholic Diocese of Bougainville.
When Christianity came into Bougainville, it really fitted well with our culture.
On this island, women hold great power. They call the shots within their matrilineal clans. Koraikove says that's why Bougainvillians are so drawn to Mary, a divine female guardian. Inside the shrine, Marina Kuresu tells me that during the uprising while hiding in the jungle, Bougainvillians prayed to Mary constantly. She says when they found that statue somehow unharmed, that vindicated Mary's powers.
When we look at the statue, we experience the real presence of Mother Mary is here. Even though it was bent, we can still feel the presence. It's extraordinary.
With her story complete, Marina finally leads me over to the statue. The icon is made of dark wood, mahogany maybe. Mary is hooded, her head bowed, hair flowing over her shoulders. As promised, the statue looks completely unsinged.
Even though it was made of wood, you just imagine it, it wasn't bent.
Do you think that God protected the statue?
Yes, yes. It's God's plan that the statue is still surviving.
As for what Marina prays for, she says it's what almost all Bougainvillians have prayed for a long time, an independent country of their own.
If people are close to Mother Mary and Jesus, then maybe independence will be brought about.
Bougainville's leaders expect to peacefully break free from Papua New Guinea and start the world's newest country by 2027. For The World, I'm Patrick Nguyen, Bougainville.
More global news and stories are still ahead for you this hour. You're listening to The World.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. The U.S. has been ramping up its military presence in the Middle East, sending ships and warplanes as a warning to Iran. Recent airstrikes on Houthis in Yemen were also meant to send a signal to Tehran, according to the Defense Department. President Donald Trump has given Iran a 2-month deadline to come to the negotiating table to make a nuclear deal. The two sides have come together on this in the past, but as the world's Shirin Jafari reports, this time around, around an agreement could prove more difficult.
It's not every day that Iran's supreme leader and the U.S. president exchange letters publicly. The two countries have been enemies since the Islamic Revolution of 1979 and the taking of American hostages in Tehran. But Trump's letter last month set off a chain of exchanges between the two leaders.
When did you send the letter?
Yesterday.
Trump disclosed the news during an interview with Fox News in March.
And you said you better negotiate, or we want you to negotiate?
I didn't say you better. I said I hope you're going to negotiate because it's going to be a lot better for Iran. And I think they want to get that letter. The other alternative is we have to do something because you can't let them have a nuclear weapon.
Iran says it has a civilian nuclear program. The supreme leader has issued a decree banning nuclear weapons. But for years, Western nations have been concerned about Iran's nuclear capabilities. In February, the International Atomic Energy Agency reported a considerable increase in Iran's stockpile of highly enriched uranium.
Not only has Iran enriched uranium at a much greater speed and to a much greater quantity, it has even experimented to enriching uranium up to 90%, which is weapons grade.
Wali Nasser teaches international affairs and Middle East studies at Johns Hopkins University. He says Iran's nuclear program has advanced since 2018 when Trump walked out of the deal that was signed by President Obama. Trump's action created mistrust, Nasser says, forcing Iran to approach any future negotiations with the U.S. with much more skepticism.
Coming to the table is obviously a very important first step, but getting to a deal is much more questionable.
It took 2 years to arrive at the previous agreement, and it involved many rounds of talks between Iranian, American, and European officials. Hamed Mousavi, who teaches international relations at Tehran University, says Trump doesn't seem to have that level of patience.
When Donald Trump humiliated Zelensky in the White House, many analysts in Tehran were saying, if this is how he's treating American allies, then a country such as Iran, which has had a very challenging relationship with the U.S. in the past 4 decades, is not going to be able to reach a deal with this administration.
But Iran cannot afford to lose this opportunity, he says. Its economy is tanking under U.S. sanctions. Prices for everyday goods have skyrocketed.
The new government of Masoud Pezeshkian came into power primarily on an agenda to reach a deal with the West and to improve the economy. So far, especially in the past few months, the Iranian economy has actually gotten worse.
In the past, economic pressures have led to anti-government protests. Iran's leaders don't want a repeat of that, says Farzan Sabet with the Geneva Graduate Institute.
It was already difficult, but it's harder and harder for ordinary people instead of Iran to manage their day-to-day lives. And so this, in a certain context, this could lead to a social explosion.
Both Iran and the U.S. seem to want a deal, Sabet says. The challenge is overcoming their differences. Iran likes to conduct these types of high-stakes negotiations in secret, he says, to protect it from domestic backlash.
With the current administration, that doesn't seem very likely, right? Because President Trump likes to tout his victories, likes to tout the concessions that have been made, and speak about them quite publicly.
This week, as Trump threatened Iran, officials in Tehran came out with their own warnings.
Ali
Larijani, top advisor to the supreme leader, said on national TV that if the U.S. bombed Iran, the country would be forced to make nuclear weapons. All this bluster worries experts like Wali Nasser of Johns Hopkins University.
There could be a spoiler, there could be an accident. What is at stake is a war in the Middle East that neither side wants. I mean, they clearly are threatening war because each of them knows that the other side doesn't want it.
Iran's supreme leader has responded to Trump's letter saying that his country is ready to negotiate indirectly. Today, American officials told Axios News that Trump is seriously considering Iran's offer. For the world, I'm Shirin Jafari.
An update now to a story we reported on Monday about 4 U.S. soldiers who went missing in Lithuania during a training exercise. As of Monday, 3 of the soldiers had been found dead. We have now learned that the 4th and final soldier has also been found dead, bringing what had been an extensive search to a close.
The four soldiers went missing along with their armored vehicle last week. It was recovered from a bog. The soldiers' commander said in a statement on Tuesday that the past week has been devastating and that although finding the missing soldiers has brought closure, quote, the world is darker without them. The Pentagon and Lithuanian authorities are investigating the cause of what they describe as an accident.
Let's go now to London, where artifacts from the British intelligence agency MI5 are now on public display at the British National Archives. Visitors can see a monogrammed briefcase left behind when a famous spy fled to Moscow in 1951. There is also a desiccated 110-year-old lemon that ended up outing a German spy. More on that in a sec. MI5 collaborated on this exhibit, which is a big deal because it did not acknowledge its own existence until 1989. Our guest is a British intelligence historian whose real name is Rupert Allison, but he's better known by his pen name, Nigel West. He's written several books about MI5 and joined us from London. I asked him about that monogram briefcase.
It belonged to Guy Burgess, one of the two Foreign Office officials who defected on the 25th of May 1951. So the Burgess and Maclean defections started the speculation into who had tipped them off, allowing them to evade capture. And that person was Kim Philby. And then when Kim Philby defected in 1963, that led to speculation about a fourth man who turned out to be Anthony Blunt. And then eventually John Cairncross was exposed as the fifth man. And that was the famous Cambridge spy ring. And on display for the first time is Guy Burgess's briefcase, which he left at the Reform Club when he fled the country. Incidentally, he left behind his passport as well.
Wow, it's incredible. I mean, a prop from a famous episode in espionage history. What about that 110-year-old lemon? I gather it helped convict a German spy in Britain during World War I?
It's a sad story, really, because it was in 1915 that Karl Müller was arrested. And it turned out that in order to communicate with his German controllers, he used lemon juice. And he was challenged with his possession of these lemons and asked what he was doing. And he said, oh, I use the lemons to clean my teeth. But when he eventually confessed to being a German spy, he admitted that that was used for secret writing.
Secret writing. I mean, this is something that I used to use in grade school. You'd write in lemon juice and you'd use some heat to kind of reveal what was written, right?
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like you could have been a real Boy Scout marker.
I was not, however. So MI5 collaborated with the British National Archives on this exhibit, Nigel. How significant is that?
Well, first of all, it's unprecedented, so that's significant. Secondly, there is a small little museum in MI5's headquarters, just as the Secret Intelligence Service also has its own little museum. Nothing like the International Spy Museum in Washington, D.C., which has the benefit of artifacts that have been collected by the CIA and the FBI.
Do you wonder if there are certain items that MI5 would not allow in this exhibit?
Yes, I remember going to the Tower of London in order to look at a chair that was used by a German spy to sit in when he faced a firing squad in 1942. And that was not ever exhibited publicly because one of the spines at the back of the chair had been broken by a bullet that had penetrated the body of this particular spy and had gone right the way through him and the chair. So on grounds of taste, there are some things that have been left out. But there's some fascinating material there, including a concealment device in a talcum powder tin that belonged to two Soviet spies arrested in 1961 in London who turned out to be American citizens.
Wow. What was that about?
Lona and Morris Cohen were communists. They were part of the Rosenberg Ring in New York, and they fled the country when the Rosenbergs were arrested, and they just disappeared from sight. We now know that they were smuggled out of the United States through Mexico, went to the Soviet Union, trained as illegal agents, so people operating under non-official cover. And they were given false passports as Peter and Helen Kroger and deployed to London, where they supported the KGB illegal resident who posed as a Canadian businessman. And all three of them were arrested in 1961. And this was one of the concealment devices that was found.
And so in a small box of talcum powder, there were these microdots. And what's on a microdot?
A microdot is a miniaturized photograph of a document. So you can reduce a large number of documents down to just periods in a book or on the back of an envelope. It's a brilliant way of, or was in those days, technologically a very advanced way of communicating and allowing agents to pass classified information to their controllers.
So, of course, there's Q Branch in the James Bond films. They show us the fantastical side of spycraft, holographic cars with ejection seats. What is the most gobsmacking piece of spycraft you've come across, Nigel?
I suppose the most fascinating item that I've ever seen in terms of fiction and nonfiction was the rolling map that was in Goldfinger. Do you remember the James Bond movie where Bond follows Goldfinger right across Europe and he's got a rolling map in his Aston Martin DB5 in 1964? And that's what you and I would call GPS.
Exactly. And so at the time, were you like, that's never going to happen?
Well, better than that. President Johnson rang up J. Edgar Hoover, the director of the FBI, and said, I've just been watching Goldfinger. I've seen this rolling map used for surveillance. Does the FBI have this? Do you use this? And of course, J. Edgar Hoover was a practiced liar and said to the president, yes, Mr. President, we're working on it, which was completely untrue because GPS satellites hadn't even been in existence at that time.
Nigel West is a British intelligence historian.
The small Himalayan country of Bhutan embraces Buddhism as part of its national identity, but it's also a young democracy, and there's been a real effort recently to keep the government secular. Reporter Sushmita Pathak looked into how Bhutan is balancing on that tightrope. She brings us the story from the capital of Thimphu.
As you walk around the perimeter of a Buddhist temple in Thimphu, you pass a row of small wooden prayer wheels along the outer wall. Worshippers spin them as they pray. Inside, young nuns dressed in maroon robes are seated on the floor chanting. Bhutan is a majority Buddhist country. Reminders of the faith are everywhere. Prayer flags on the side of the road, giant prayer wheels in public squares. But Buddhism isn't just a way of life. It guides policy.
We have championed in the world about how less material we are, how much value we give to social harmony and well-being. We have spent many decades talking about gross national happiness.
That's Dr. Lotay Shering, Bhutan's former prime minister, explaining here that Bhutan's famous gross national happiness index is rooted in Buddhist teachings. It considers it a more holistic indicator than GDP. But when it comes to politics, there's a firewall. It dates back to 2008, when Bhutan became a democracy and adopted a constitution.
The constitution does state that religion or the religious people must be above politics.
Karma Ura is an academic who was part of the constitution drafting committee. The constitution effectively bans Bhutan's religious community from voting or running in elections.
Formally registered monks and a priest cannot become politicians. Elected posts are beyond them now. That might be affecting about 17,000-18,000 people.
Bhutan's entire population is just about 750,000 people. So upwards of 17,000 monks who can't vote, let alone run for office, is a lot. This kind of exclusion is almost unheard of in the modern democratic world. But Kinley Shering, managing editor of Bhutan's national newspaper, says the rule is important.
We want to clearly separate religion from politics. We have seen, learning from the world, from our neighbors, how extreme politics and religion, can be very dangerous to the political stability, communal harmony, peace of the country.
So what do monks think of this rule? I asked Lopen Gembo. He's a former advisor to Bhutan's central monastic body. For the monks, he says dharma, or faith, comes first.
Apart from the practice of the dharma, I think everything others become the secondary. There is no inclination to actually take part in the process of voting.
He doesn't feel disenfranchised. My tour guide, Sewang Nidup, says that's because Buddhism teaches you to let go of all worldly desires.
For a Buddhist person, secular system or the power or the money is just momentary. So for the monastic order, this momentary pleasure
is not attractive.
For the most part, the monastic community stays out of government matters. But tensions do arise sometimes, says Kinley Shering, the newspaper editor. For example, the tension between vegetarianism and livestock farming.
That, from a Buddhist perspective, is insensitive. It's like anti-Buddhist almost, because, you know, we are raising animals, killing animals. The spiritual leaders also have sometimes, you know, written to the government saying that we should not be doing this.
Bhutan has also been criticized for restricting minority faiths. The constitution guarantees religious freedom, but preaching is banned for all non-Buddhist religions. And there are no churches in Bhutan to serve the small Christian minority there. Meanwhile, Buddhism is recognized in the constitution as the nation's, quote, spiritual heritage. The word secular might not capture that complexity.
What label do we want to put on it?
Doreen Van Noren is a researcher who's written about religion and politics in Bhutan. She says the tiny nation has its own hybrid form of secularism, with Buddhism functioning less as a state religion and more as a philosophy or value system. And that, in and of itself, is not unique.
Every state and every constitution has some kind of underlying values, even if we're not acknowledging it.
Throughout the Western world, too, the line between majority religion and politics gets blurred. In the US, the role of Christianity in national politics and identity is a topic of passionate, ongoing debate. In France, expressions of personal faith, like the Muslim hijab, have been banned in some settings, in the name of secularism. Bhutan's model may not be flawless, but it could hold lessons for others, Van Noren says, including across the border in India, where Hindu nationalism is rising.
I think it can serve as an inspiration for India of keeping the religious sentiments, giving space for it and at the same time keeping it in check and having tolerance and diversity.
In Bhutan, that means thousands are excluded from participating in democracy. For the world, I'm Sushmita Pathak, Thimphu, Bhutan.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Our next story is about a folk musician from Liberia who lives in Tennessee. Monrovia refers to his style as Afro-Appalachian. He told his story to Maclete Hedero for the Project Movement, all about music and migration. Maclete caught up with Monrovia to talk about his new EP titled Atonement.
Monrovia is a stage name taken from the city where he was born, Monrovia, the capital of Liberia.
I was born into the middle of the First Civil War.
He was born in the 1990s during a long period of violence, two civil wars that together spanned almost 15 years.
You know, I lost my mother and father during this. I have a sister and brother that live there still. Two of my other brothers fought in the war. They were child soldiers and lots of memory, but we were rescued by a missionary family that was living there and stayed during the war.
In hindsight, it seems like they were randomly chosen. Some of the siblings left with the missionaries and some stayed behind with their grandmother.
Like, I could have been the one that stayed back, you know?
Right.
And it just so happened that my grandmother said, no, like, take him. No, please take him. He needs to go with you. And we were taken back to the States from that time.
If it takes time, I've tried to open up my...
Monrovia has been releasing a cycle of four EPs. Act one in the cycle is called The Wandering, and that's where Monrovia's journey starts. He was lucky. He got out.
'Cause I'm always on my own.
Monrovia grew up the black son of a white missionary family, first in Florida, then in Montana, then in the Appalachian Mountains of eastern Tennessee. He went to church. He did American kid things. But for many years, he didn't really understand what he'd gotten out of.
I wasn't, at this point, I'm not even thinking about going back. You know, I'm like, oh, I never want to go back to that place.
It was Monrovia's adoptive dad who decided in the early 2000s it was time to go back to at least visit the people and the places he had left behind.
But we go back during the Second Civil War. My dad takes me back because he's like, you need to go see your family. Your grandma wants to see you. And it's just utter chaos. And my dad thinks that it's not as bad as it was, but it really was bad. We get there, the UN is everywhere. The child soldiers had taken over the capital city of Monrovia. Once we get there, they take over, the airport's burned, so we're stuck in this place. My dad is a very intense person, so he decides to leave me with a bunch of people I knew from before, like a bunch of Liberians and friends that I had known when I was a bit younger. Mm-hmm. And so I'm now back as a Liberian again.
Monrovia was 12 years old at the time of this trip.
You know, I'm not seen as anything but what the people are. You know, the kids are around with AKs and RPGs, kind of controlling the city, walking around, guns to someone in the corner. You're just trying to mind your own business and live in a very, in chaos, run by kids.
And how does this change you? Does it change you?
I mean, I think the main thing that I took away from this trip is I wanted to know why I was spared or chosen in a way to be taken from this place.
That visit to Liberia lasted just 2 weeks. Afterward, Monrovia left once again with his American family while his brother and sister stayed behind. But those 2 weeks had changed him. Now Monrovia could see how wildly their lives had diverged. He couldn't unsee it. And it haunted him.
I wanted to just live an American experience and forget all of that.
Monrovia didn't have a word for it at the time, but he can say it now. Survivor's guilt.
But I knew that was wrong, though. That's the thing. That's how I know now that's what it was. Because the whole time I just felt bad about not trying to connect with my people, my heritage. Mm-hmm. Not trying to remember all the suffering. And also the good that comes from even places like that, too.
No, you're never ready. It's common sense. It's miles and miles till I get my rest.
Act 2 in the cycle of EPs is called Trials. And that is what Monrovia's adolescent and young adult years became. He stayed in Tennessee. He started releasing music, but it felt a little aimless. He was running from something he couldn't escape, endlessly rolling a boulder up a hill and never quite arriving.
I was battling drug addiction and drinking and depression. And I was at my wit's end, had no money. I was living with my friends up a place in Lookout Mountain, up on the mountain right above where I live now. And the whole time, my heart is hard as ever. Hard as ever.
No, I have reason, can't hold me down.
And it took so much work to finally get to a place where I saw what I was, you know?
Rain on the streets, I'm walking in silence.
Act 3 is called The Dying of the Self. It's hard. What was that moment? What was that moment where you saw what you were?
I was in church, and it was one of those moments. My dad was preaching. He's a pastor, and I'm not really much of someone. Even growing up, I thought for some time that I had a problem with me because I never really cried or anything. I was always very just like with things that were, if I watched things that were super intense or, you know, anything like that, I was very stone-like. In my emotions.
But that day in church, Monrovia suddenly began to weep.
My dad saw me and, you know, he came out. Yeah, he literally just came up to me near the end of his sermon, just came down and saw me and, you know, kind of gave me a hug. And it was there where I felt like I released just so much things I was holding inside at that point. Mm. In those tears.
Crooked the road, and the one driving.
Monrovia's new EP is called Atonement. The story is from the project Movement with Maclita Darrow about music and migration. Find it wherever you listen to podcasts. Movement is produced by Ian Koss and Maclita Darrow with support from the Mellon Foundation.
Past the dogs and the horses. Now you find yourself here, past the dunes.
the World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio in Boston and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Join us right back here tomorrow.
The World is supported by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world, macfound.org. By the Lumina Foundation, committed to a fair, universal system for learning beyond high school that offers every American the chance for a better life, luminafoundation.org. By the Ford Foundation, by the Henry Luce Foundation, by the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include the Kelson Foundation, Roman Mars, Gavin Selmanese LLC, the Schmidt Family Foundation, Ed and Lillian Schneider, and Marianne Tagney. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.